of all the intelligence he had furnished to date and everything he knew about the Tube Alloys project. A remarkable testament to his scientific prowess and, if it fell into British hands, the most damning evidence of his guilt. Some 3,500 miles away in Tehran, Rudolf Hamburger was pursuing the role of spy with just as much vigour as his ex-wife, and exactly none of her success. His incompetence might have been comical had it not ultimately proved tragic, with an impact on Ursula's life that neither could have predicted. Hamburger's mission in Iran had started well. Having obtained a job designing a new building for the Persian Finance Ministry, Rudy doggedly set about gathering information on the road and rail infrastructure built by the British and Americans to keep the Soviet armies of the Eastern Front supplied. Ever suspicious of his allies, Stalin demanded that his spies find out if the accumulation of British and American forces so close to the Soviet border might presage more malign intentions. "My task," wrote Rudy, "was to monitor all these plans and movements, to establish the number of troops and the nature of the military forces which were being concentrated under the guise of transport deployments, especially in the south of the country, where the oil fields are." Moscow Center supplied him with a bulky radio transmitter in an aluminium case, which he hid, suspended by a rope, inside the disused chimney of his rented apartment. For more than a year, the architect spy supplied a trickle of low-grade intelligence, much of it garnered from locals employed by the Allies. In the dry climate of Tehran, the bouts of malaria he had contracted in a Chinese prison recurred less frequently. He even saved some money, which he sent to Ursula via an American bank. A letter from Rudy arrived at Avenue Cottage just before Christmas 1942, after a tortuous journey through the wartime postal system. 11-year-old Michael was excited, imagining the day when his father would fulfill his promise to return. "I kept expecting him to appear, as he had before. I really loved him." Rudy Hamburger's life in Tehran was lonely but exotic, and between architecture and espionage, extremely busy. His communism reflected the zeal of the convert. He was almost happy. Then, as usual, it all went wrong. Ruhollah Karubian was an Armenian-Iranian working as private secretary and translator for the American superintendent of the railway service. One afternoon over tea, Hamburger bluntly asked Karubian to sell him secret information, declaring that he was Russian and wanted to find out all he could about British troops and military installations. Rudy offered to pay handsomely for anything affecting American foreign policy in the Middle East. Karubian immediately relayed this startlingly unsubtle approach to his boss, who informed American military security. A microphone was installed in Karubian's sitting room, and the next time Hamburger came to tea, a stenographer with earphones was hiding in the adjoining bedroom, taking notes. As instructed by American intelligence, Karubian feigned interest in Hamburger's offer and asked for details. Hamburger persistently refused to disclose the names of the people for whom he was working. He did, however, offer a lecture on international politics. "Hitler must be beaten, but that shall never stop our work. You see, Karubian, today England, America, and Russia are allies, but after the war is over, they may be enemies again. My group wants every bit of information they can get. We want to make the new order complete after the war. We must know the answer to all the Allies' motives." That was enough for the eavesdroppers. On the 19th of April, Rudolf Hamburger was arrested by American military police. A search of his apartment uncovered $2,000 in traveler's checks and a false Honduran passport, but not the radio in the chimney. Hamburger admitted he had been caught red-handed and was willing to accept the consequences, but he would not give his associates away. After a week in American detention, he was handed over to the British authorities in Iran. Colonel Joe Spencer of the Defense Security Office knew he had a spy on his hands, but what sort of spy was unclear. Hamburger was clearly very intelligent and easy to deal with, but the German architect refused point-blank to answer questions and seemed entirely unworried by threats and harsh questioning. Spencer left him to stew. Rudi Hamburger was too honest a man and too hopeless a spy to retain his secrets for long. Deprived of reading matter and company, he grew depressed, then talkative. Spencer, in the time-honoured manner of clever jailers, provided him with magazines, cigarettes, and congenial company. As the weeks passed, Rudi dropped ever heavier hints. He maintained that he was not working against the Allies, but was merely collecting information for his group, the particulars of which he resolutely refused to disclose. He was quite confident that his group would ultimately intervene on his behalf. He hoped his group would then give him a good job as an architectural engineer. Otherwise, he would return to China. Finally, in August, he admitted he was working for an ally. Spencer laughed. There are 25 United Nations, and you can't expect me to go around and ask them all. I'll give you a hint, said Hamburger. What other ally besides the British and Americans is interested in transporting Persia? The next day, after 4 months in detention, Rudi came clean. He admitted that he had for a long time been a professional agent of the Russians and would remain one. His task, he alleged, was to collect political information about Allied intentions, especially from army officers. He admitted he had bungled the interview with Karubian. Rudi suggested Spencer put in a phone call to the Soviet authorities to check out his story. But promise not to say I made this suggestion, as my whole future depends on it. Spencer contacted the Soviet military attaché, who confirmed 3 days later that Hamburger was working for the Russians, and asked for him to be handed over. As far as Colonel Spencer was concerned, the affair was closed. We handed him back to the Russians at dead of night on a lonely road, surrounded by all the mystery of the most dramatic spy film. This was a simple case. The apprehension, through ignorance, of an Allied agent and his straightforward disposal. Rudi also believed the future would be straightforward. Hamburger seemed quite confident that when he was handed over to the Russians, they would do nothing to him. He said he would go on working as an agent, but probably elsewhere. The British and Americans now had an extremely fat file on Rudi Hamburger, and proof that Ursula Kaczynski's first husband was a self-confessed Soviet spy. Ursula and Rudi might be divorced and thousands of miles apart, but their stories and their fates were still inextricably linked. As a spy, he posed little threat, except to his ex-wife. Rudolf Hamburger was flown to Moscow at the end of August, convinced that he would receive, if not a hero's welcome, then at least a friendly, commiserating pat on the back and a new assignment. As before, when the friends had sprung him from a Chinese prison, the centre would probably send him on another comfortable rest cure before redeploying him. After all, he had demonstrated a remarkable degree of persistence, commitment, and loyalty over the years. Rudi thought he might well be promoted. He could not have been more mistaken. Viewed through the lens of Soviet paranoia, Rudolf Hamburger was not just inept, but highly suspect. 2 days after arriving in Moscow, he was arrested, accused of working for American or British intelligence, and thrown into investigatory detention, a euphemism for indefinite imprisonment and interrogation without trial. He had got away from the British too easily. The circumstances of Hamburger's release from detention in Iran gave rise to the suspicion that he had been recruited by a foreign intelligence service. By the perverse logic of communist persecution, Rudi's protestations of innocence merely confirmed his guilt. You were bought by our enemies, and you came to work for them as a spy, the interrogator insisted. Yes, you became a spy. Come on, you dirty spy. Admit they bought you. You've become a spy. Confess. His request for a lawyer was ignored. For 24 hours you are kept awake through hunger and stress, he wrote. If only you could think of nothing and sleep. The food is dire. Hunger is a terrible torture. His health deteriorated rapidly. In a few months, he lost 45 pounds. There was no formal trial, merely a verdict. Rudolf Hamburger was a socially dangerous element, guilty of political crimes under Article 58 of the Penal Code, and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. The centre did not intervene. His ex-wife's success as a Soviet intelligence officer counted for nothing. My case as a foreigner is clear. Enemy spy. They stamp me as their adversary, as a traitor. This is harder to bear than the prison cell and the hunger. Like so many others, he was swallowed into the great maw of the Russian gulag, another innocent enemy of the people. Rudolf Hamburger's descent into hell had begun. Around the time of Rudy's arrest, Ursula Burton was promoted to the rank of colonel, the only woman to rise so high in Soviet military intelligence. She was not informed of the promotion. Nor would she learn until many years later that she had been awarded a second Order of the Red Banner, another unprecedented honour. The relationship between the spy and her spy masters, like all espionage relationships, operated on a need-to-know basis. Moscow decided that Sonya did not need to know what rank she had attained, nor that the father of her firstborn child was now a prisoner of the regime she served. Mrs. Burton of Avenue Cottage, Summertown, spent the winter of 1942 cycling around Oxford on her new bike, collecting wartime rations, caring for her children and husband, following the progress of the war. She was polite, modest, and innocuous. Another ordinary housewife, making do, digging for victory in the back garden vegetable patch. As she waited for her baby, she sewed a new seat cover for her bike, daisies on a green background. She was on good terms with her neighbours and occasionally took tea with Sissy Lasky in the main house. Nina attended nursery school in Summertown and joined the Girl Guides. Ursula's German accent eroded further. She was developing a genuine affinity for the British, admiring their stolid faith in the certainty of eventual victory. Like all ideologues, she saw the war through the prism of her own politics. The British people were sympathetic to the Soviet Union. Ursula's four sisters would each marry an Englishman and settle in Britain. Berta pined for her former life in Germany, but accepted that Britain was now their permanent home. Ursula's beloved Aunt Alice, Robert's sister, and her husband, the gynaecologist Georg Dorpalen, clung on in Berlin to the end. On the 22nd of September 1942, Alice wrote to her beloved German housekeeper, Gertrude, "Now it is time to say goodbye and to thank you from the bottom of my heart for the friendship and helpfulness that you have shown us in difficult times. My husband is wonderfully calm, and we are ready to face our grave fate, if only we survive it." 3 days later, the Dorpalens were rounded up and shipped to Theresienstadt concentration camp, where they were murdered. Ursula admired Uncle Georg's courage, but could not help wondering, was it also brave that when Hitler came to power, he did not follow my father's advice, but remained in his German homeland, which he loved? Despite a growing patriotism for her adoptive country, Ursula spied on Britain without protest or doubt. Len, increasingly impatient for his call-up papers, was prepared to fight for Britain while spying for the Soviet Union. They saw no conflict of interest. The party and the revolution came first, and by defending communism, Ursula believed she was helping Britain, regardless of whether Britain wished to be so helped. Years later, she insisted, "We would have refuted any suggestion that we, or the British comrades working with us, were betraying Britain." She might not regard herself as a traitor to her adopted country, but that is how most Britons would have seen her. And there is something in her defensive tone that reflects her own discomfort. As always, She made friends easily, but she was deceiving every single one. Ursula believed it was possible to be both a Soviet spy and a British loyalist. MI5 did not agree. Mrs. Burton of Avenue Cottage drank tea with the neighbours, joined in their complaints about the shortages, and agreed that the war must be over soon. Nina drew an enormous Union Jack and put it in the window. Michael and his friends staged mock battles in which the British always defeated the Hun. Ursula put a little money into the National Savings Movement to help fund the war effort. Colonel Kaczynski of the Red Army, meanwhile, was running the largest network of spies in Britain. Her sex, motherhood, pregnancy, and apparently humdrum domestic life together formed the perfect camouflage. Men simply did not believe a housewife making breakfast from powdered egg, packing her children off to school, and then cycling into the countryside could possibly be capable of important espionage. Ursula ruthlessly exploited the natural advantage of her gender. Only a woman could have seen through Ursula's disguise. The counterintelligence section of MI5 contained only one woman, and she was on Ursula's trail. Chapter 19. Millicent of MI5. Miss Millicent Baggett was the sort of Englishwoman who strikes fear into the heart of foreigners, children, and bank managers, and tends to be described as formidable. Code for unmarried, humourless, and slightly terrifying. One of the few women in MI5, and the first to achieve senior rank, she was highly intelligent, dedicated, professional, and, when the occasion demanded, blisteringly rude. She wore austere spectacles and did not suffer fools gladly. Indeed, fools were seldom left in any doubt about what they were. The daughter of a London solicitor, Baggett was educated by a French governess until the age of 12, then at Putney High School before reading classics at Lady Margaret Hall, Oxford. In 1929, at the age of 22, she joined Scotland Yard's special branch as a temporary clerk in the counter-subversion section. When that division transferred to MI5 in 1931, Baggett went with it, beginning a lifelong career in the security service. She lived with her nanny in Putney. She wore a hat indoors. At 4:45 every Tuesday afternoon, whether or not there was a war on, she left the office to sing in the Bach choir. She sang alto, and frequently fortissimo. A stickler for procedure and a difficult colleague with robust opinions, was the verdict of one colleague. She was exacting and demanding and did not dissemble when faced with those less intellectually gifted than herself. Around the office, Baggett was known as Millie, but never, ever within earshot. The renegade MI5 officer, Peter Wright, wrote, "She was slightly touched, but with an extraordinary memory for facts and files." Her colleagues might run for cover when Millicent was coming down the corridor in full voice, but none doubted her abilities. Even the FBI's director, J. Edgar Hoover, no admirer of either MI5 or women, wrote her a personal letter of appreciation. Though wholly different in character, she was Ursula's opposite and double. Highly trained, devoted to her job, undaunted by men, and as firm in her anti-communist beliefs as Ursula was committed to communism. Baggett would eventually achieve a literary immortality as the model for Connie Sachs, the eccentric and obsessive spinster in the novels of John le Carré. No one in Britain knew more about the internal threat of communism than Millicent Baggett. In 1941, MI5 formed F Division, specifically to counter subversive activity. The anti-communist section, F2C, was theoretically run by a veteran officer, Hugh Shillitoe. But his was merely a vague supervisory role because it was thought better to have a man nominally in charge. There was little question that Millicent wore the trousers in the communist hunting unit. Miss Baggett is a really outstanding character. She has been working on the communist problem for over 20 years and has a positively encyclopedic knowledge of the subject. She is the most valuable member of the whole division. That glowing appraisal came from the overall chief of F Division and Baggett's immediate boss, Roger Hollis, the former tobacco company executive who had been knocking around communist circles in Shanghai at the same time as Ursula in the 1920s. The contrasting roles played by Millicent Baggett and Roger Hollis in the Sonia case would give rise to one of the longest and most damaging conspiracy mysteries in British history. Millicent Baggett began tracking the Kaczynski family from the moment they arrived in Britain. She vigorously opposed Jurgen Kaczynski's release from internment. "We have a great deal of information about this man, indicating that he is taking an active part in anti-British propaganda, but we are finding some difficulty in convincing the Home Office," she wrote to MI6. The F Division files described Jurgen as an extreme communist and fanatically pro-Stalin, one of Moscow's most brilliant and dangerous propagandists. It is claimed that he is an illegal in contact with the Soviet Secret Service. When Ursula Kaczynski applied for a British passport, it was Baggett who pointed out that there were existing files on both her and her father, and that the marriage to Len Burton was almost certainly a scam to obtain British citizenship. She alerted the Oxford police when the Kaczynskis settled in Oxford in 1941 and re-examined the letters Ursula sent to her family from Switzerland between 1938 and 1941, which had been intercepted and photographed. Millicent, it was said, could smell a rat at 20 paces, and in the Kaczynskis she had picked up the scent of an entire nest. Baggett had Ursula Burton firmly in her sights. But it was Len, as the male of the household and therefore by assumption the greater threat, who initially attracted most suspicion. Just a few weeks after the Burtons moved into Avenue Cottage, a policeman knocked on the door and politely invited Len to come to London on any day that is convenient for a meeting with security officers. Len was unworried. Having assisted British intelligence in Geneva, he was expecting some sort of approach, and perhaps even a job offer. An MI5 officer, Desmond Vasey, and Arnold Baker of MI6 were waiting in room 055 of the War Office, where MI5 held external meetings, when Len arrived on the 18th of September 1942. "There are several odd aspects to Burton's story," MI5 noted. Ursula's assertion that her husband had been convalescing in Switzerland when he himself made no mention of ever having had tuberculosis. His claim to have inherited a large amount of money in cash from French relatives. His antipathy towards people in authority and his shifty manner. The two officers peppered him with questions, but after several hours, Len was told he could return home. "On the whole, Burton made a good impression," wrote Vasey. Millicent Baggett and her stalkers were not about to leave it there. The next day, a warrant was obtained to intercept the Burtons' letters on the grounds that this man has recently returned from Switzerland, where he is thought to have been in contact with agents of a foreign power. Hugh Shillito, Baggett's nominal boss and de facto deputy, wrote. "To my mind, the story suggests many interesting possibilities. Burton may have been engaged in espionage on behalf of the USSR against Germany from Switzerland. It is known that the Russians used the international brigades as recruiting grounds for secret agents." MI5 sent a memo to the Oxford security officer. "Please arrange for the police to make discreet inquiries whether Burton travels, when and where, what friends he has, and how he is occupying his time." The police duly reported back that "The house is rather isolated and they appear to have little contact with neighbours. They appear to be living quite comfortably, paying 4.5 guineas a week in rent." A considerable sum given that neither had jobs or any other known source of income. Detective Inspector Arthur Rolfe of the Thames Valley Police did, however, spot one conspicuous feature of Avenue Cottage. "They have a rather large wireless set and recently had a special pole erected for use for the aerial. That vital piece of information was passed to MI5 in January 1943, at a time when Ursula was running Klaus Fuchs at full tilt and transmitting to Moscow at least twice a week. Moreover, according to a senior officer of the Radio Security Service, the interceptors had identified an illegal radio transmitter operating somewhere in the Oxford area. A memo in the Burton's MI5 file baldly states, "The most interesting point appears to be their possession of a large wireless set. You may think this worthy of further inquiry." But Roger Hollis, the head of F section and Millicent Baggett's immediate superior, did not think the radio mast merited investigation. Nor did he follow up the other clues that life at Avenue Cottage was not what it seemed. Hollis similarly failed or declined to investigate Klaus Fuchs. Time after time, what now appear to be obvious leads that should have led straight to Ursula were left by Hollis to wither on the vine. The theory that Roger Hollis was a Soviet spy, recruited in Shanghai by Richard Sorge and implanted inside British intelligence, first emerged publicly in 1981 and has been running ever since, refusing to die despite repeated official denials. After joining MI5 in 1937, Hollis was steadily promoted, eventually becoming Director General in 1956, a post he held until his retirement 9 years later. His accusers claim that Hollis's seniority enabled him to protect numerous Soviet spies in Britain, including Ursula, who deliberately fueled the conspiracy theory. In later life, she denied knowing Hollis from Shanghai, but wondered, was it possible that there was someone at MI5 who was, at the same time, working for the Soviet Union and had protected us? To this day, MI5 flatly rejects that possibility, its website insisting the allegations against Hollis were investigated and found to be groundless. But the pattern of Hollis's actions, or more accurately, inaction, in respect of Ursula Burton, Jürgen Kaczynski and Klaus Fuchs, is strange, to say the least. In 1940, when Millicent Baggett was campaigning to keep Jürgen interned, Hollis stated that he didn't believe for a moment that Kaczynski is an OGPU Soviet intelligence agent, a view endorsed by the head of MI5 on the basis that Hollis knows Kaczynski personally. The nature of this personal connection has never been established. According to the writer and journalist Chapman Pincher, Hollis's indefatigable accuser, when the American embassy asked MI5 to draw up a list of foreign communists in the UK, the Kaczynskis were omitted. Hollis was similarly unwilling to pursue Fuchs. Miss Baggett seems to have highlighted the Fuchs case at once, writes Fuchs's latest biographer, but Hollis was singularly relaxed about the potential threat he posed. It may be no coincidence that Hollis was a friend of Neville Lasky, in whose cottage Ursula was living, with a large radio antenna over her head. Paul Monk, heir to the late Chapman Pincher as chief prosecutor in the saga, writes that as head of F section, Hollis consistently stymied efforts by Baggett's section to investigate Ursula Burton, her husband, family and principal agent Klaus Fuchs. Baggett had been on Sonia's trail as far back as early 1940. It was Hollis who squelched her suggestions that Sonia be treated with suspicion and kept under surveillance. Baggett was suspicious of Sonia's movements, given her known background, but was waved aside by Hollis. There are only two ways to interpret Hollis's behaviour. He was either a traitor or a fool. To hide inside MI5 for nearly 30 years while protecting a host of Soviet spies and covering his tracks would have required a spy of rare intellectual agility. No one would have described Roger Hollis that way. He was a plodding, slightly droopy bureaucrat with the imaginative flair of an omelette. Lying is easy. Maintaining a panoply of lies, cover-ups and diversions for years and remembering them all is exceptionally difficult. Even Kim Philby, with his preternatural talent for deception, left clues that exposed him in the end. Hollis was simply not equipped with those kinds of skills. The weight of evidence currently suggests that Hollis was not treacherous, but incompetent. He was really quite thick. In Ursula's MI5 file is a note written by Hollis in response to an FBI inquiry, which perfectly encapsulates his attitude. Mrs. Burton appears to devote her time to her children and domestic affairs. She has not come to notice in any political connection. Like so many others, Hollis could not see Ursula for what she really was, because she was a woman. In Canada, on the 19th of August 1943, Churchill and Roosevelt signed the Quebec Agreement, a secret arrangement to collaborate on building the atom bomb. The US and Britain also agreed not to use the technology against each other or a third party without mutual agreement, and not to tell Stalin what they were doing. This vast industrial project would require the construction of nuclear reactors, diffusion plants, and a massive injection of American funds and expertise. British scientists would take part in the Manhattan Project, but as junior partners. To maintain security and keep the project beyond the reach of German bombers, the program would shift to the United States, and Klaus Fuchs would move with it. Central to the Anglo-American arrangement was a decision to keep all aspects of the atomic bomb project secret from the Soviet Union. Further evidence that, while the Allies might be on the same side, they were on very different historical paths. Some claim that Moscow learned about the secret Quebec Agreement from Ursula just 16 days later. The Russian intelligence writer Vladimir Lota, citing sources off-limits to other researchers, writes, "On the 4th of September, Yu Kaczynski reported to the Centre information on the outcomes of the conference in Quebec." The Quebec Agreement was a closely guarded secret, and how Ursula obtained it, if she did, remains a mystery. Fuchs almost certainly did not know about it. Perhaps this molten lump of weapons-grade intelligence came via Jürgen or Robert Kaczynski through one of their British political contacts. But it's equally possible that the claim Ursula passed on this information is false, concocted long after the event as propaganda to show her and the GRU in the best possible light. Ursula herself made no claim to have passed on the substance of the Quebec Agreement on the 4th of September. But soon after that date, 8 months pregnant, Ursula struggled to London in a rainstorm to meet Sergei, probably Barkovsky. He brought a special message from the director, praising me for a report I had sent, she wrote. The director had said, "If we had 5 Sonyas in England, the war would be over sooner." It is possible that the praise, lavish by GRU standards, may have been in response to a report from Ursula informing Moscow that Britain and the US were now formally working together to build the bomb behind the back of the Soviet Union. Ursula was buying groceries in Summertown when she went into labour. At 3 p.m. she gave birth to a boy, 3 weeks prematurely, in Oxford's Radcliffe Infirmary. By 5 p.m. she was sitting up in bed writing to her mother. "At 12:45 I was still out shopping, and now the baby is already 2 hours old, so you can see what an easy time I had." Len was at another rendezvous with Soviet intelligence in London and arrived at the clinic late that evening. For several minutes he contemplated the tiny infant in Ursula's arms and then said, "I have never seen you so happy. You look like 2 Sonyas." Peter Burton was born on the 8th of September 1943. A few days earlier, his mother may have passed a secret to the Soviet Union that started the Cold War. His father had spent the day at an illegal meeting with their Russian spy handler, and on seeing the mother of his child a few hours after the birth, he addressed her by her code name. Within hours, his mother was back at work, conducting espionage as usual. In all other respects, Peter's birth was perfectly normal. Klaus Fuchs was among the 17 British-based scientists selected to join the Manhattan Project. He had been involved in Britain's atomic weapons research from the start, and Pyles insisted on taking along his gifted colleague. Before the scientists could leave for America, General Leslie Groves, director of the Manhattan Project, demanded assurances that all have been properly cleared. A routine background check on Fuchs concluded he was gentlemanly, inoffensive, and a typical scholar, so absorbed in research work as to have little time for political matters. Hollis himself waved through the paperwork for Fuchs to become a British citizen in July 1942. No objection is seen to this application. As a naturalised British citizen, Fuchs was now legally entitled to an exit permit and a non-immigrant visa for the USA. The only objection was raised by the indefatigable Millicent Baggett, who wrote a terse note complaining that she had not been informed that Fuchs was now British. "We knew his naturalisation was under consideration, but not that it was a fait accompli." It fell to Ursula Burton to ensure that in America, Fuchs would be able to continue providing Moscow with a stream of atomic secrets, now from the heart of the Manhattan Project. Fuchs would initially be working at Columbia University in New York, and Ursula was instructed by the center to identify a meeting point in the city and provide Fuchs with a set of signals, timings, and a password to facilitate contact with Soviet intelligence. Ursula reached back into the memories of her youth for a rendezvous spot. She chose the Henry Street Settlement, the immigrant hostel run by Lillian Wald, where she had lived in 1928 as a 21-year-old bookseller. As the day of Fuchs's sailing approached, the centre sent a message. "Sonia, I have received your telegram about the departure of Otto to America. The locations and conditions of the meeting in New York are clear. Give Otto our thanks for helping us and give him £50 as a gift. Tell him that we think that his work with us in a new place will be as fruitful as in England." Fuchs would continue spying with barely a pause, but in a different country, with a new handler, and for a different branch of Soviet intelligence. Rivalry between Russia's civilian and military spies was, and remains, intense. The NKVD had evolved into the NKGB and would soon become the KGB, the largest and most feared intelligence bureaucracy in the world, part espionage gathering machine, part security service, part secret police. In theory, military espionage was exclusively the responsibility of the GRU. In reality, the KGB under Vsevolod Merkulov, a member of Stalin's Georgian mafia, recognized no limits to its power. Merkulov was one of the earliest Cold Warriors, with a particular antipathy for capitalist Britain. "Sooner or later there will be a clash between the communist bear and the Western bulldog," he declared. "The time will come when we will water our Soviet horses in the Thames." The KGB was running an extensive spy network in the UK, and in 1943 it identified Fuchs as a potential target for recruitment, only to be informed that he had been a GRU agent for almost 2 years. The KGB did not like playing second fiddle to its military counterpart, and in August 1943, 4 months after Merkulov was appointed, it launched a power grab. The atom spies working for the GRU were transferred, wholesale, to the KGB. Enormoz, the operation to penetrate the Manhattan Project, was under Merkulov's control. Though he did not know it, Fuchs was now a KGB spy. On the 5th of February 1944, Klaus Fuchs stood on the corner opposite the Henry Street Settlement on Manhattan's Lower East Side, holding a green book in one hand and a tennis ball in the other, exactly as Sonia had instructed. At 4 p.m. on the dot, a stocky man appeared wearing a pair of gloves and holding a second pair in his left hand. After a minute, he crossed the road, approached Fuchs and asked, "Can you tell me the way to Chinatown?" "I think Chinatown closes at 5 o'clock," Fuchs replied on cue. The man introduced himself as Raymond. His real name was Harry Gold, and he was a chemist, a communist, and a Soviet spy, Ursula's successor on the other side of the Atlantic. They walked to the subway and caught a train uptown, and then a cab to Manny Wolf's restaurant on 3rd Avenue. Gold later reported to the KGB. He is about 5'10", thin, pale complexioned, and at first was very reserved in manner. He obviously has worked with our people before, and he is fully aware of what he is doing. Ursula's choice of meeting place was ideal, Gold wrote, and beautifully deserted, a spot where no one would think anything of two people walking towards one another and making conversation, even if one was holding a tennis ball and the other had four gloves. So began the next phase of Fuchs's espionage odyssey, during which he would witness the first atom bomb test in the New Mexico desert and pass the secret of its construction to Moscow. Before handing him over to the KGB, the centre made an assessment of the case. During his time with the Red Army Intelligence Service, Fuchs transferred important materials containing theoretical calculations on the splitting of the uranium atom and the creation of an atomic bomb. Total received from Fuchs for the period 1941 to 1943, more than 570 sheets of valuable materials. Fuchs was out of Ursula's hands, but he was not out of her life. The German scientist had learned little about the girl from Banbury during their collaboration, but what he knew was enough to destroy her. The atom spy was Colonel Sonya's greatest triumph and potentially her nemesis, an unexploded bomb with a delayed fuse. Chapter 20, Operation Hammer. In late June 1944, Ursula received a message from Jürgen asking her to come to London urgently. As brother and sister strolled across Hampstead Heath, Jürgen explained that he had just received an unexpected visit from a young American intelligence officer who had asked for help, recruiting spies to be parachuted into Nazi Germany. The Americans were specifically looking for exiled Germans living in London who were opposed to Hitler and might be willing to carry out intelligence-gathering operations inside the Third Reich on behalf of the Americans. "Do you know anyone like that?" the earnest young American had asked. Jürgen certainly did know several such people, and so did his sister. On her return to Oxford, Ursula dashed off a message to the centre. Lieutenant Joseph Gould of the US Army was a publicist for the motion picture industry, a union organiser and a new recruit to America's military intelligence service. A brash 29-year-old New Yorker, he was enthusiastic, patriotic, and imaginative to a fault, with a highly developed sense of the dramatic. Gould was a director of his own unfolding spy movie. His intelligence reports read like Hollywood film scripts. When America joined the war, Gould enlisted in the US Army's intelligence branch and was dispatched to Britain immediately after D-Day with a specific mission in mind. The Office of Strategic Services, or OSS, precursor to the CIA, had been formed in 1942 to coordinate military espionage behind enemy lines. Within the OSS was the Secret Intelligence Unit, and inside that was the Labour branch, dedicated to using Europe's secret underground union organisations for intelligence gathering. Hitler had tried to smash the German labour movement, yet some organised labour groups had survived, a core of clandestine resistance to fascism. As the Allies closed in on the Third Reich from east and west, American intelligence was hungry for strategic information on the Reich's military and industrial production. Workers were in a unique position to provide it. "We can take advantage of the hatred of Hitler by members of the European labour movement," wrote Arthur Goldberg, the New York lawyer and future Supreme Court justice who headed the labour branch. Thousands of persecuted German trade unionists had fled abroad, and many had settled in Britain. If some of these anti-Nazi exiles could be smuggled back into Germany as spies, they could establish contact with the dissident labour groups, a ready-made espionage network, and gain access to vital intelligence about German defences, industrial and military production, politics, and civilian morale. Thus was born the OSS plan, codenamed Faust. A team of good Germans would be recruited and trained in the UK, equipped with the latest communications technology, and then parachuted into Germany, where they could blend in, link up with the workers' movements, and begin transmitting intelligence that would set the stage for the last act of the war. Finding people prepared to parachute blind into Hitler's Germany, without reception committees, safe houses, or friends, would not be easy. But with his trades union expertise and bubbling energy, Joe Gould was the man to try. Gould arrived in London on the 13th of June 1944 and set to work recruiting the cast for Faust. On an inspired hunch, he took himself off to a second-hand bookshop specialising in foreign books on New Bond Street, a known hangout for émigrés. The owner, Morris Abbey, took an immediate liking to the round-faced, bespectacled young army lieutenant who entered his shop and declared, as if requesting a set of rare books, that he was collecting anti-Nazi Germans. The bookseller told Gould that one of his regular customers was a leader of the expatriate German community and a founding member of the Free German League of Culture, an offshoot of the anti-fascist Free Germany movement, the loose affiliation of exiles united in opposition to Hitler. Abbey gave him the telephone number of Dr. Jürgen Kaczynski. A few days later, Gould found himself taking tea in Hampstead with a lean man in early middle age and explaining that he was looking for agents capable of undertaking delicate and highly hazardous missions inside Germany. As soon as the excitable young American left, Jürgen contacted his sister. In German legend, Faust is a man prepared to give up his soul in his quest for earthly knowledge. Faust gets his wish by making a pact with the devil. Every spy master's ambition is to infiltrate a spy into the enemy's intelligence service. The Soviets had successfully done this in MI6 with Kim Philby, and MI5 with Anthony Blunt. Here was Ursula's opportunity to plant not just one, but several of her own agents inside the American intelligence service on a top-secret mission. On Moscow's instructions, she compiled a list of reliable German communists in Britain who might be prepared to work as spies for the Americans, but also willing to pass every scrap of information on to the centre. The Faust spies would be agents of American intelligence spying on Nazi Germany, but in reality double agents working for Ursula Kaczynski of the Red Army. In spy jargon, a cutout is an intermediary who stands between a spy and his handler, ensuring that if an agent is apprehended, he cannot identify his controller and compromise the whole network. Moscow warned Ursula to be on her guard and find someone to act as liaison between her and the Faust spies. She turned to an old acquaintance, Erich Henschke, the comrade who had helped her set up the Marxist Workers' Lending Library in 1929, selling communist literature from a Berlin basement fragrant with pigeon guano. Chased out of Germany by the Gestapo, Henschke had undergone military training in the Soviet Union and then volunteered to fight in the Spanish Civil War. Henschke was always a bruiser and a rigid party disciplinarian. Along with his gun, he carried a large megaphone through which he exhorted his fellow communists into battle. In 1939, he was admitted to Britain with a false French identity card and an assumed name, Karl Castro. He was now working in the Wall's ice cream factory in Acton and performing clerical work for the International Brigade Association. Ursula found Henschke a slow thinker who found it difficult to reach decisions, but he was conscientious and reliable and knew everyone in the German community. Henschke was the ideal cutout. Ursula instructed her brother to introduce Henschke to Gould. They got on famously, and the young New Yorker immediately offered Karl Castro a job, a monthly salary of £5 in exchange for help in enrolling agents for Operation Faust. Ursula handed Henschke a list of 30 potential recruits, mostly former German trades unionists who had fled to Britain via Czechoslovakia. She'd already passed the names to Moscow for approval, along with biographies and photographs. "I did not take a single step without consulting the centre," she wrote. In August 1944, in a Hampstead pub, Gould held his first meeting with four Germans who would form the nucleus of the Faust operation. Paul Lindner was a 33-year-old lathe operator from Berlin and an organiser of the German Metal Workers Union, whose good looks were marred by a scarred face and a set of broken teeth, the legacy of a savage beating at Nazi hands. Lindner had escaped to Czechoslovakia with the Gestapo in pursuit, and in 1939 made his way to Britain, where he met and married an English woman and settled in London. Lindner's close friend was Anton Tony Roux, a lithographer who had churned out anti-Nazi leaflets and fake passports for escaping Jews from his illegal Berlin printworks until he too was forced to flee and make his way to London via the Czech underground. Kurt Gruber was a coal miner from the Ruhr Valley. Adolf Buchholz, a metal worker from Spandau, Berlin. Each of these men had been active in the union movement and the anti-fascist resistance. They were all die-hard communists, hand-picked by Ursula. Henschke had explained that while they would be working for the Americans, their ultimate masters were in Moscow. As Ursula put it, the comrades knew that this had been approved by the Soviet Union. The Germans, uncomfortable in inexpensive suits and neckties, listened attentively as Gould explained that he was looking for men to parachute into different parts of Germany and send back information to American intelligence on conditions inside the Reich. He inquired about their backgrounds, what cities they knew, where they might have contacts, who would shelter them. Under a formal employment contract from the US government, each volunteer would receive $331 a month through an account at Chase National Bank. Their families would be paid compensation if they did not return. The Germans nodded keenly, finished their drinks, and asked for a little time to think about these things and to talk with others of their group. A few days later, Henschke told Gould the men were ready to volunteer. He did not say that the order to do so came directly from Ursula and the GRU. From the other candidates, Gould selected three more volunteers. The operation was split into five distinct missions. And with the whimsy common in intelligence nomenclature, each was given a themed code name. Hammer, chisel, pickaxe, mallet, and buzzsaw. These were dubbed, collectively, the Tool Missions. The new recruits did not reveal that they were all members of the KPD. How far Gould was aware of their politics remains unclear. He certainly knew the men in his toolkit were left-wingers, but equally certainly he did not know that they were secretly working for Moscow. Lindner later speculated that Gould might have been a communist sympathiser. "One could guess that he is an American comrade," he wrote. But Gould was not a communist. He was not interested in the politics of his recruits. These free Germans clearly had the necessary pluck and union connections to play the parts allotted to them, and that was enough for Joe Gould. Preparations for the Tool Missions began at once. At Ringway Airfield near Manchester, the Germans underwent intensive parachute training. At a secret spy school in Ruislip, they were issued with false names, identities, and cover stories, and put through rigorous physical training. They learned to shoot and how to kill soundlessly with a knife. Each recruit would be dropped as close as possible to his hometown, the better to blend in. Civilian clothing commandeered from newly arrived German refugees was stored in a warehouse on Brook Street, Here the men selected their costumes for the forthcoming performance. The common denominator was that all the goods, suits, shirts, ties, hats, belt buckles, cufflinks, tie pins, shoelaces, had been manufactured in Germany. A single British label could mean death. German-made luggage, cigarettes, razors, toothpaste and spectacles were bought in neutral Sweden and shipped to London in the State Department's diplomatic bag. The master forger of the OSS, Bob Work, a graduate of the Chicago Art Institute, turned out a set of fake German passports, travel permits and identity papers indistinguishable from the real things. The men had not seen Germany for years, so they were quietly inserted into German prisoner of war camps to learn about conditions inside the country and get a feel for living among their fellow countrymen again. What they learned there was disturbing. Most of the German POWs clung tenaciously to the belief that Hitler would eventually triumph, though some thought he should have waited until victory before exterminating the Jews, because the genocide had brought the Jews of the USA and England into the front line against us. The training at Ryslip followed a rigid schedule. Tactics school on Mondays, how to deal with SS patrols Wednesdays, cartographical studies Fridays. The most important training involved the latest American breakthrough in communications technology. A handheld, portable, two-way radio that made ground-to-air communications possible for the first time. A predecessor of the mobile telephone, the equipment had been designed at the RCA Electronics Laboratories in New York before being refined and developed for the OSS by DeWitt R. Goddard and Lieutenant Commander Stephen H. Simpson. The device would eventually become known as a walkie-talkie. But at the time of its invention, this pioneering gizmo went by a more cumbersome and quaint title, the Joan Eleanor system. Joan was the name for the handheld transmitter carried by the agent in the field, 6 inches long and weighing 3 pounds, with a collapsible antenna. Eleanor referred to the larger airborne transceiver carried on an aircraft flying overhead at a prearranged time. Goddard's wife was named Eleanor, and Joan, a major in the Women's Army Corps, was Simpson's girlfriend. The Joan Eleanor JE system operated at frequency above 250 megahertz, far higher than the Germans could monitor. This prototype VHF very high-frequency radio enabled the users to communicate for up to 20 minutes in plain speech, cutting out the need for Morse code, encryption, and the sort of complex radio training Ursula had undergone. The words of the spy on the ground were picked up and taped on a wire recorder by an operator housed in a special oxygen-fed compartment in the fuselage of an adapted high-speed bomber flying at over 25,000 feet. Outside the range of German artillery. An intelligence officer aboard the circling aircraft could communicate directly with the agent below. As a system of communication from behind enemy lines, the JE was unprecedented, undetectable by the enemy, easy to use, and so secret that it would not be declassified until 1976. At Ryslip Training School, the German volunteers learned to use Joan, while air crews of the 25th Bomber Group based at RAF Watton were instructed on handling Eleanor, under the codename Red Stocking. The call sign from Joan to Eleanor would be Heinz. The corresponding call sign from Eleanor to Joan would be Vic. Special coded messages on the BBC, in numbers, would indicate to the agents inside Germany when to make transmissions and when and where to expect airdrops. The signal that there was about to be a broadcast of coded information relevant to the tool missions was a burst of Rustle of Spring, the popular solo piano piece written by Norwegian composer Christian Sinding. On the 22nd of November, Simpson carried out the first operational test of the system by successfully recording transmissions from an OSS agent codenamed Bobby, while circling at 30,000 feet over Nazi-occupied Holland. Washington was delighted with the way the mission was progressing, and so was Moscow.